ACK, session number 30285.
John Dixon, reel 6.
Yes. And so, after all that training at Aldergrove, we became operational and joined the standby list for operations.
What about your crew this time? Who were the crew this time?
The two wireless operators were officers, private officers, but very experienced and coming towards the end of their operational tours. One of the pilots was a warrant officer, the other was a flying officer, and strangely enough, you'll see why in a moment, I can't remember some of the people. Anyway, on the 20th of July, I did my first operational sortie, which was a convoy escort, and again in that month we did again. I'm just trying to. We were involved in all sorts of things there, escorting the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, and we were involved in that major offensive in July that was put on by the CNC of Coastal Command. They were called Sea Slug operations. We were taken off from our North Atlantic duties and sent down to the Bay of Biscay.
Before we do that, can you tell me what, because you said your first two operations were convoy escort, what that actually entails, how long you're out for, what you're doing, how the aircraft's operating during that period of time?
We would have been briefed on the position, the known position of the convoy at a particular time, and we would be told whether it was heading out into the Atlantic or coming back to UK from America. Or coming from the southwest. That, of course, became so much of a routine of just hoping that the weather was going to be good and that we would find the convoy. There were strange things going on. That first convoy escort into the Atlantic, we were airborne for 12 hours and 45 minutes, which is a bit short, really. And then a week later, we're out again doing another convoy escort, and that time we were airborne for 14 hours. So that could have been doing anything. But we would stay with the convoys until such time as we reached prudent limit of endurance and would need to leave the convoy to get home ourselves, all being well.
With the 14-hour one that you did, how long will you take finding to locate the convoy? And how long would you be around the convoy and then the journey back? How long would you be?
It varied, of course. It varied enormously. Depends where the convoy was, of course. Some would be deep into the mid-Atlantic, and that might take us 4 or 5 hours to get out there to find the convoy. And somewhat similar to come back. So you can see that on a long trip, we would have probably been around the convoy 5 or 6 hours. And that would vary, of course.
And would you circle around the convoy, or would you take up a particular position? Would you be ahead of it, behind it?
It depended on what we were briefed to do. Sometimes we would be briefed to sweep up ahead of the convoy and see that all was clear up there. And then we would come back and we'd circle the convoy and swing round it and keep an eye on it. Not too close, because the Navy were a bit sharp with their guns. So one never got quite too close to them. They seemed to be very anxious to fire at something. So we kept reasonably away from them. And just kept doing various type things. Like I said, sometimes in front of the convoy, sometimes sweep at the back of the convoy. And depending, because the Commodore, who was in charge of the convoy, and could talk to us, tell us what he wanted us to do, if anything. Other than that, we would just stay with the convoy until it came time for us to leave, to get home.
Can you take me through your kind of duties on, say, a routine convoy escort duty?
Yeah. Well, if we start at where we should start, and that's at the operation aspect, coastal commanders were not like the other commands, obviously. For instance, whereas bomber command stations, as you know, would send off their squadrons en masse, all the serviceable aircraft would get into the air. Fighter command, if they were in, would send up their squadrons by wings and so on, but not coastal. We had a system where there would be X number of crews on the standby list, and of course that, as people did trips, so you moved up the standby list. So when you got to the top of the standby list, you could guarantee that you would be going somewhere very shortly. And they would allow us 3 hours in which to sort out the briefings, the aircraft, and food, and all of that, and getting the aircraft ready and kind of before we would take off. That was fairly standard. So having had our food, our fried eggs and bacon, and our, which was very good. Once, because of the cancelled trip, we had 2 breakfasts, which was a great thing to do. Yes, and so the key to it, of course, would be down at the operations room, where they would have received a signal from group headquarters nominating the top, whatever was to be done. So we wouldn't know exactly, or we wouldn't know at all, actually, what they wanted us to do on any particular sortie until we had our briefing. And there we were briefed by the operations officers to what we had to do, where we were expected to go, what type of convoy it was, and any other associated problems. Then we would be briefed by the various professionals. The WASA operator side would tell us the frequencies that we would be using and all that sort of thing. And the code signals for the day in particular, and very lights and things, and the pistols and colours and things. Then the navigator would be briefed. He'd disappear and start to work on his plots. The Met people would then give us a brief as to the sort of weather we would experience on the way there and on the way back, and what it would be like when we landed. Unfortunately, that didn't prove to be very accurate in those days, particularly with the North Atlantic. Yes, so then having been briefed like that, we were then taken out by transport to our aircraft, where we had quite a busy time sorting all the things out. It wasn't a simple matter of jumping in, and things had to be stacked in, things had to be checked, and see that all the ammunition boxes were in the right places, and the everything was in order, and May West were available, and bits of flying kit, like Irving jackets and things. We had to have those because it was so cold sometimes. And then ultimately, having cleared all that, we would be cleared for takeoff, and then we'd start the airborne aspect of it. And that could be any time of the day or night. Sometimes we'd take off at 1 or 2 in the morning, and of course that meant that we would not have a night's sleep. We would have been aware that we were taking off, but you can't go to sleep at least 9 o'clock at night or something, and things like that. So sometimes we would take off with no sleep, and we would lose a night's sleep, and you wouldn't regain that. Now, unlike some of the other aircraft, like the Catalinas and the Sunderlands, there was no luxury bits in the Liberator at all. There was nowhere you could stretch yourself for 10 minutes. Nowhere. And so that meant that you were constantly on duty. There was no breaks, no sitting out, no sleeping, no nodding off. You just stayed doing what particular duty you were doing. And that caused some difficulties, if you think you hadn't been to bed that night. Then assuming that you were doing a convoy escort, that was it. We would set course on the navs, bit figures as to where we should go and what time we should get, and so on and so on. And then we would eventually get to the convoy and make contact. And so they knew who we were. Then we'd fire appropriate cartridges of the day so that they could see we were friendly aircraft. And then if they wanted to pass any instructions to us as to what they wanted us to do or what had happened, then the Commodore would contact us and tell us what he wanted to do. So that's what we would do. Sweep ahead, sweep round, do a square search, anything that may be affecting the convoy safety. And that then, as I said earlier, we would stay with them as long as possible and then set course back. But by that time, it's possible that another aircraft from them might also be taking over the duties. So I mean, as we'll see later on, that happened on some occasion. So having completed perhaps 10 or 12 hours of being airborne, we then set course for home and return. That might take 4 or 5 hours. And then we would land and back to the operations again, where they gave us a debriefing on what happened on the cruise and what happened with the convoy and so on. And then we would land, and all being well, we would go to bed and sleep.
A couple of things about operating like that. You mentioned, obviously, the fatigue element. Was it hard sometimes to stay awake at your post, or was there always something to do on that kind of length of flight?
There were times when I used to see the pilots asleep, because the sun would be coming in through the flight deck, and it was all very cosy up on the flight deck, not like on the beam or in the turrets. So it was rather cosy, rather nice for slipping off and having a little nap. So I have seen on time where both pilots were asleep.
I take it the aircraft was on automatic pilot at that stage.
That's right. And they would be quietly nodding off there with the sun coming in, very understandable. But yes, one got very tired towards the end of the flight. But even then it was difficult, because there would quite often be questions of navigation, and the radar operator would be busy trying to position the aircraft vis-a-vis the radar, things like that. The wireless operator would be constantly on alert, because there would be times, as we found out later on, when you would get messages from group headquarters telling you to do something or other. And so coming back after 15, 16, 17 hours of being airborne, yes, you're beginning to feel quite tired, which may be the cause of some of the problems.
What about food?
Food was quite extraordinary, really. Quite extraordinary. See, unlike the other aircraft I mentioned to you, we had no facilities at all. Nothing. They gave us a tin box in which there were some sandwiches and some sweets. And if there was any fruit available, we might have an orange or something, and some sweets and some chocolate. And that was about all we had. And there were no facilities to cook anything, like on a Sunderland, for instance, or where they could go and lie on bunks and go to sleep. There was none of that. It was a stark wartime operation. Facilities.
So you had no access to any kind of warm food?
No. Nothing.
What about the call of nature? How did you handle that?
Oh, yes. We had an Elson down in the beam. So the beam gunner would be interrupted from time to time. Someone came down and said, I want to use that. And I love the story where a second pilot had occasion to go down to use the Elson. So he sat himself on it. And suddenly there was an attack on a U-boat. So there was the usual banging and noise of the guns being fired and so on. And the next minute he shouted, "I've been hit." And they got him off the house, and we found all he'd done, he got the contents of the house and splashed on top of him by one of the shells. So it was all pretty crude.
How did the Elson function? Is it a normal toilet, or is there...
No, it's just a little circular tin with a lid on top, you know, and that was it. You didn't empty it.
Would you have to use it? Would you find you had to use it a lot in flight? Or
yes. Yeah. We didn't use it generally for any bowel action. Try to restrict it to having a wee. but we didn't eat much at the end. I come to think of it, something like vacuum flasks, big one, and there was water in there. We did have a plug which we could plug in on the flight deck, and we could boil up some water, and that was the extent of the to be available.
And what kind of flying kit were you wearing? Because obviously you mentioned it's cold in the aircraft. What would you wear?
It depended entirely on the weather conditions generally. Normally we would take our Irving jacket with us, and Mae West, of course. But we wore some silk underwear and a thick woolen polo neck and our flying boots. So generally, if things were normal, we could go around the aircraft with just our battle dress. And of course, if you went into the turret where it was cold, you'd put on silk gloves and gauntlets and things like that. And you'd put your Irving jacket on to sit in there, because it could get very cold. And you'd certainly be freezing on the beam guns, so you needed to be kitted up there. So we put our flying kit down in the back. So if you wanted it, you could put it on. And that's how we managed. But in the summer, and remember, we weren't flying at particularly high heights. The operational height that we might be doing our patrols at might be between 3,000 and 5,000 feet. So in summer, it was reasonably pleasant. No harm done. In the winter, different story.
What about your hands? Because obviously you're having to manipulate things, aren't you, in your role? So what would you wear on your hands?
I didn't wear anything inside on the flight deck. It was nice and warm and quite cosy. And we had a screen into which the radar set was behind, so you could tuck in there to do your stint, and it was rather cosy and warm, and you could have a look at the radar screen and keep an eye on things without going to sleep, I think. And on the flight deck, there was never any occasion to use anything like that, or to have your adaptive hands affected in any way. But in the rear of the aircraft, the position was reversed. It did get cold, so you put silk gloves on, gauntlets, and flying jacket, Irving jackets, and your flying boots. And that would the same thing applied in the turrets, which was one of those days.
And can you give me a little bit more of an idea of how the rotor worked as to the position and role that you would be doing?
The rotor?
Yeah, how you would...
Yes, we were limited to an hour per duty. So that meant that we would start off with the four, wireless radar, mid-beam gunner, tail gunner, and then we would just move them around. We'd move the wireless operator to the radar, and then the radar down to the back, and they would move up from the back. And so it circled all the way around. And you have to remember that aircrew, the affinity between them all was of such a nature that we wouldn't have any nonsense or anything like that. Everybody knew that this was an essential requirement. So it all moved very, very smoothly, and people would know it. Look at what, I've been down here an hour now. Right, change over. And they would change. And that's how we managed that. And because the only thing you have to do generally in the turret is fire the guns and pull the coffers from the shooting, so they were, that didn't require much to do. But the beam guns were free mounted, and that meant you had to be able to handle them, and being biggish guns relatively, you had to be able to handle those against the slipstream and things like that.
Was there an element of boredom in the work at all, or was it because you were changing round? I mean, I'm thinking maybe you sat in a turret for an hour. How you was that? Was there elements to that were boring?
In a turret, it was never boring in a turret. You had to constantly be searching, you know? And I mean that's what we're there for. And so if you were in charge, you'd be manoeuvring the turret round you. And another thing was to give some help to the navigator. For instance, when a crew was really experienced and their airmanship was of a high standard, the navigator wouldn't have to call up the tail to get a drift, for instance. The tail gunner would be watching, and if he saw that suddenly there was an increase in the drift, perhaps a marked increase for various reasons, he would then get onto the navigator, you know, and say, "Navigator, tail gunner, I've got a 20-degree starboard drift."
How would you assess the drift as a
tail gunner? We had a drift meter in the turret, which you could wind around, and you could see the markings as you turned it round. That was always a bit hairy, you know, because you had to unlock the turret, and if you weren't careful, it would be swept away. with the wind. So you had to be very careful. Quite exciting if you did slip on the winding and suddenly found that you went pew. Yes, and so we had this meter markings, degree markings on the turret pole, so you could just wind the turret round and you could pick up what the bearing, what the drift was, and that was it. So when obviously on long flights it could get bored, but see, everybody was doing their professional jobs and they were important. The wireless operator can't afford to be bored, and certainly the radar operator can't afford, he's constantly got to be searching, you know, what's up, you know, and particularly if you're in areas where convoys are or there's been U-boat attacks, you've got to be constantly. Navigator worked very hard. So there, apart from say a very on the beam gun, you wouldn't be bored. You'd be busy doing something or other.
And while you're watching, say while you're in the turret or on the beam gun, if you were watching, would you have a technique for looking across things? I'm thinking of, would you scan the sea in a certain pattern, or would you have your
No. What we would do is normally be looking out towards it on an angle. But then, if we wanted to take a real sweep, we could put the turret on and move the turret to acute angles and just bring it round and have a look. Then bring the turret round again and then take a look at the other side and stay doing that for a bit. So there are always things to be doing. And if only you could keep warm sometimes. Yes, there were periods when it was boring, but you know, Coast of Mind crews are very professional, and it's being said that they were the most highly qualified and trained crews in the RAF. I have a book here which makes that statement, and I think that's true. A lot of the crews were on their second tour of operations, and they were. Their airmanship was of a high standard, and so it was very professional.
And I take it there was a need to focus while you were doing this, that you had to focus on the role that you were doing. Is that right?
I think that would be a need. As you moved, you slotted in, you might get a brief from the person you've taken over from, say things like, weather's bad, difficult getting that signal. Something like that you might get. But you slipped straight into your role, whatever it was, very professionally.
You've mentioned the weather a little bit. Was that sometimes a factor in locating a convoy? Would that be a problem, or were you able to do that on the radar?
Some of our crews didn't find convoys for various reasons. Sometimes the convoy would move off course because it had received a signal that there were U-boats up ahead, and we might be going active to a place where they'd move from some other direction. We didn't have many difficulties. I think there's only one item in my logbook where we didn't find a convoy that we were sent out to escort, and that was probably the weather. They recall us, but other than that, but it required navigation of the highest order to find some of these convoys.
Was there a procedure if you got to the point where you thought the convoy was going to be and it wasn't there? Would you have to fly a pattern to try and establish it?
Yeah, we did square search patrols in the area in which we were told the convoy ought to be in. Now, we could pick up a convoy which was flying higher, probably 30-odd miles, 30 to 40 miles. So you could sweep on a search pattern in those areas and where you could pick up the convoy by radar, which was of enormous help, and even if the weather was bad. So that, I think we only missed out one convoy that we were recalled from because of the weather. So we didn't see that as an insurmountable problem, the weather. Otherwise, there would have been a lot of times where there was no cover in convoys, and that would have been difficult.
And what about the radar equipment in the Liberator? What was that?
Yes, now that's a very interesting one. When we were shown the equipment that we were now to operate, it bare no resemblance whatsoever in any shape or form to the equipment that we'd been trained on Scotland, and at our heavy but it was American equipment that was known as the Mark V. It was in fact derived from the British Mark III, and the Americans had taken it and manufactured it with their superior capability, and that was wonderful. It had a, unlike the time-based line which I described to you, here we now have a visual presentation of a planned position indicator where the radar swept round and we had the ability to switch it into close range or far range, so we could sweep through the radar at any range. We could limit its range to 10 miles and pick up a big signal, or we could have it set on the higher ranges, 30, 40 miles, and pick it up there as a small signal. And it was highly efficient in at that time. Its only great problem was that when there were heavy seas, and the sea return that came onto the planned position indicator meant that if there was something in that sea return area, it was extremely difficult to find, and if it was a U-boat just on the periscope, of course it was in that area, it'd be almost impossible, but normally it was capable, as I'll show you a bit later on, of its capabilities.